NARIC is your record industry knowledge network.
So good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name is Tess Taylor. I'm the president of the National Association of Record Industry Professionals. Delighted to have you here with us this evening for our sponsorship endorsement deal discussion. Tonight we will be looking very closely at sponsorship and endorsement deals, and delighted to have a great expert with us. I wanted to update you, as mentioned earlier, Jen Linus of U3 Promotions had to call in sick this morning. We regret that she can't join us. We weren't able to get a suitable replacement on such short notice, but given the depth and breadth of Greg's knowledge, I'm confident that you will walk away with much more than you bargained for. So, for those of you here for the first time, a quick word about us, the National Association of Record Industry Professionals, or NARIP, our acronym, N-A-R-I-P. We are an organization that promotes career advancement, education, and goodwill among record executives. We're now in our 13th year. We're based here in Los Angeles with chapters in Atlanta, San Francisco, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Houston, Philadelphia, New York, and London. We are the leading record industry organization for career development, education, and access in this business. We have job listings online. We have many great and useful resources, including a mentor network, help with resumes, career advancement strategies, all that sort of thing you'll find online. We help our members to identify opportunities for themselves and their companies and to advance their careers. Please have a look at the NARIP brochures tonight, or ask me or any of our staff if you have questions. As I mentioned earlier, we're always looking for good people, anything from volunteers to leadership in our many chapters. If you have any interest in getting involved at any level, please talk to us after the program tonight or at the break. We have a number of exciting events coming up. As I mentioned earlier, in London in November, we're flying two of the top music supervisors here from Los Angeles to London, Chris Mollaire, who is the music supervisor for Vampire Diaries and Pretty Little Liars, and Andre Von Forster, who's worked on everything from The OC to Grey's Anatomy and many, many independent films. We have been having great success with these supervisor sessions here in Los Angeles, in New York, and in Berlin. I returned from Berlin in September, where I flew Gary Calamar of True Blood and also Andrea Von Forster. So they seem to be quite well received because of the limited enrollment nature, the small format that we've developed. So if you want any more information about that, please have a look online at NARIP.com. You'll also find upcoming events in your handouts when you receive them on page 2. So happy to have Gary Fine here today, who will keep us honest, a wonderful attorney in the music record brand industries, has a long and storied career and has been a speaker at a previous event where he really gave his opponent a run for the money, I must say, Gary. So special thanks to Chris Constable here at SAE and everyone at SAE Institute. We produce many of our programs at SAE nationwide in Atlanta, in San Francisco, New York. We love SAE, and it appears that SAE may love us, and we're very happy about that. So I want to also thank Daniel Higgins for all of his help, especially lately when it's really been piling on thick. The young Ernie Gordon, also tremendously helpful. I want to give special thanks also to Dijon Esquerica and Sine Hartung for their help this evening. And we appreciate the use of your materials in our handout when we get it later, Gary. So we'll open the program tonight with a discussion of the most important deal points in sponsor endorsement agreements today. Then we'll take a short break and come back for audience questions. So now to the program. We've seen a huge change in the role of sponsors and brands in the music industry in recent years. No longer avoided, brands are actively courted and sought out as a viable support mechanism in the ever-changing and challenging artist development process. We thought it would be a good time to discuss how these deals are negotiated, important deal points, and leverage artists may have to enjoy greater flexibility and create long-term careers for themselves. We're absolutely delighted to have a top expert here tonight who will share his insight on how to make the best possible deal. Will you please join me in welcoming Greg Weissman? So, Greg, thank you so much for being here. Can you tell us, get us rolling with how these deals changed in the last few years.
Well, what's interesting is let me take a step back and talk about what's going on in the wholesale and the retail business in the last 5-10 years. I think for a number of years, we had a proliferation of a lot of private label manufacturing and a lot of unfettered growth among small to medium-sized wholesalers and manufacturers of all sorts of different consumer products. Mm-hmm. You always had the big public companies, the big Fortune 50 or Fortune 100 companies. But what you had were thousands of small independent manufacturers of just stuff, consumer goods, handbags, shoes, watches, sunglasses, cosmetics, apparel, every type of apparel. And they enjoyed a lot of flexibility because there were a lot of retail doors to sell those goods to. And this is when both the heyday economically, macroeconomically, but also from just a pure vertical distribution standpoint, mm-hmm. who you could sell to. There was a mass consolidation that happened, really, I would say more in the last 5 years. At the retail level, it probably goes back 10 years. If you remember 10 years ago, 15 years ago, even just the federated group of consolidated companies, these were independent. Right now it's one company, one holding retail company that owns what used to be Bullock's Wilshire, Broadway, Macy's Men's, Macy's Women's, Bloomingdale's, and about half a dozen other department stores. The Magnin chains, the I Magnin, the Joseph Magnin, they're gone, they're swallowed up.
I had no idea. What's the name of this company?
Federated.
So it's worse than the music business.
Correct. Robinson's May, gone. So at the mid-tier level, Mervyn's gone. Kmart, now a division of Sears. Target and other people have made incredible strides, and there are some success stories at retail. But the critical issue for the suppliers, the manufacturers, the designers in this space is that their places to sell those goods, and I come mostly from the apparel and fashion background, are now gone. It's consolidated. In the last 2 or 3 years specifically, what we've seen is the specialty store boutique retailers, which were thousands of independent doors available, especially on the West Coast, to what we call contemporary designers, mm-hmm. the people selling the $60 to $80 T-shirt, the Vince, the James Purse, Ever, you know, brands that seemingly had price points that you never quite understood why someone could spend $200 on a hoodie. Those retail stores have struggled tremendously, and a lot of that business, they've gone out of business. So from a wholesale and a retail standpoint, starting with retail, the choices aren't there. The open-to-buy dollars aren't there, meaning that what used to be buyers in each independent department at a Nordstrom, or in this case a Federated, would be looking to pick up new labels, new brands. They've stopped doing it. They're trying to put their arms around whatever standing or existing brands with goodwill and public recognition they possibly can. Gave a speech a week ago to an accounting firm, their national apparel group, about branding, celebrity branding in particular. We talked about the fact that if you watch the most recent Macy's commercial, for example, look what brands they're showcasing for their holiday season. It's going to be Martha Stewart, Diddy, Donald Trump, Jessica Simpson. These are celebrities. These aren't branded goods. It's not Tommy Hilfiger. It's not Liz Claiborne. There's been a paradigm shift that the same way I think the studios go out and want to market the 6th, 7th, 8th iteration of Batman or some recognized name to the public, it's happened really in retail as well. And celebrities can advantage themselves with this shift because there are more of those deals open. Mm-hmm. We can talk about how those the independent deals have changed, but the landscape itself, to me, I want to give that background.
That's fascinating to me. I'm thinking of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Isn't that unprecedented levels of concentration? Isn't there any stopping that?
That's without getting political, some would argue that during the Bush 2 years that there was no antitrust, there was no, companies with market share that were beyond anything that anyone had ever seen, Microsoft gobbling up everything. Down to 3 oil companies, down to 5 banks. I mean, arguably, yes, I would say that there's been a accretive nature to really all big business that has been largely unchecked.
Okay. Wow. Okay. That's I didn't know this. That's amazing. Okay, so we've got Federated. Are there any counterparts to Federated, or are they just the biggest?
In the department store business, you have Nordstrom still standing independent. You have Federated owning a lot of space. That's about it. Arguably, at the that's considered sort of better. At the higher end, quasi-luxury, contemporary to luxury, Neiman Marcus, Barney's, and Saks Fifth Avenue.
Okay.
Which Saks is now a division of a company called Profits, which also owns a department store chain called Parisian, and they were accretive 5-10 years ago as well. Profits bought Saks and then changed its name to Saks because it's a better name.
Interesting.
So Barney's, Saks, and Neiman still exist. You know, some of the smaller specialty stores, I won't name names, but some of the ones that you've heard of on Robertson in Malibu owe my clients tons of money. It looks great. The store's open. They're broke. And if you travel down Montana Avenue in Santa Monica as a litmus test for kind of how the market's doing, I mean, it's vacancy after vacancy. And all the stores that were there 5 years ago between, you know, Father's Office and 17th Street, they're all gone. They're all new.
Okay.
One of the things that happened, which was interesting, is the retailers took a huge beating because in the heyday of 07, 08, you saw everyone doing really well in one store decided, I've got to have a second store. I've got to have one in Montecito now. I've got to have one in Malibu and Cross Creek. I've got to have one in New York. And so what probably could have been sustainable growth for a single retail door, these guys got greedy in the heyday, opened the second one, opened the third one, opened the fourth one, paid top dollar at its location, and a lot of them have struggled.
Sounds like the record industry, because that was a big problem. There was an overexpansion at retail, and then the CD kind of, you know, peaked. Wow. Okay. So much to learn. So many parallels in our industries. So you've given us a landscape. So then back to my opening question. And this obviously has caused the deals to change. How have the deals changed in recent years?
People have been more selective.
Okay.
So I think during the feeding frenzy, you saw even sort of D-list reality stars. The third guy kicked off Survivor, you know, were getting deals. And it was, these were predicated on, you know, the agents and the managers looking for alternate sources of revenue for musicians and actors as the music business suffered and became basically touring revenue. How do I, you know, how do I create more revenue, and how do I, the agent, get my percentage of it? So they got creative and thought that they could do some of these branded deals. By this, for the same reason that we're talking about new designer resources having issues, new celebrity resources generally struggle as well. There's brand name, immediate Q factor recognition when it's a celebrity. Kim Kardashian decides to launch an apparel line. Well, it's going to do better than some unknown from Fitum that just graduated. That's the advantage. The disadvantage is the what I call the open to buy dollars, which is what do we have left as a buyer each quarter or each season to purchase new resources, take a chance. That's dwindled down. People are less risky. And you're seeing from a pure specific deal standpoint, the guaranteed dollars that we used to see, gone. People are not taking those chances. The top-level celebrities will still be able to command a premium.
Okay.
But I would argue that where that used to be everyone from that D-level reality star, you know, to Tom Cruise, the bottom has fallen away. Now it needs to be someone real. And is someone real can still get a deal.
Is there a middle class available?
There is a middle class.
Okay.
And, you know, it never ceases to amaze me which celebrities are able to create a deal.
I did. Snooki?
Hey, you know, they watch the, people watch the show. So it's also product specific and demographic specific. You know, I thought it was very interesting. A recent deal of a lot of fanfare is, oh dear, her name escapes me, Modern Family, Colombian actress, Sofia Vergara. She just did a gigantic deal with Kmart. And she picked, she could have taken any price point and any demographic, and she went with a Kmart deal, which I thought was interesting.
Okay.
Maybe telling about the marketplace, you know. Aspirationally, a lot of the actors and actresses want to start at the top. A lot of them fancy themselves designers, and we'll talk about kind of their participation, their creative control, their ownership, ultimately, of a brand or a piece of the company, which has been part of the dynamic.
Right.
That's changed. brands themselves are no longer afraid of staying at the top. Another huge dynamic is there's a business idiom in the fashion world that says you can only go up, you can only go down. Once you go downstairs, you can never get back up. Meaning if you're a luxury brand and you open your distribution to anything less than where you previously were or a lower price point, you'll never get it back up. And that's probably true as a rule. But the exception, which is the capsule collection that people are doing for Target or other mass market or mid-tier retailers, Prinsa Schuler, you now saw Missoni do this phenomenal play at Target, where evidently they sold so many goods that you know it crashed the website, the Target retail website. So you're seeing people kind of take the old business idioms of the past and say, where are the dollars? The dollars are probably now a little more downstairs. Luxury still does very well. It never ceases to amaze me. The top of the top, I mean, you may have, may not have read about Mary-Kate and Ashley's $39,000 backpack. That was last week. There's someone that's going to buy it. I mean, $1,000 denim, you can sell. $200, tough. You know, the price point of, and I always use as a barometer, women's contemporary denim, which used to be at 125, then it was 145, then it creeped to 175, then as True Religion came into the fold, it went north of 200. That's a tougher play now. And you saw that the price points came down, and competitive brands, because of a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is Old Navy and some of the really good mass market guys got so good at making denim that they could do $19 stretch denim with a finish that was identical to what you're paying $250 for. And you tie that into a failing economic climate, and all of a sudden that's disaster for your contemporary brand, which is, if I can't deliver a better product, then why in the world would are people paying $200 for it?
Well, what we're going to talk about tonight is, I'm always interested in the top-level deals. What's Madonna doing? What's, you know, what are the top people, Lady Gaga, because you want to look at that as a benchmark. But the reality is that most of the artists in the industry are not there yet, obviously. So we're talking about the middle class. We're talking about artists who are still trying to make a name for themselves, get themselves established, have a little bit of traction growing. People like Cameron here in the front row, Tony Smith, you know, talented artists working very hard to you know, get recognition and have a toehold in the business. We have Michael Haddad here, who's a manager. He's got a nice young artist that he's working with. We have Sine here from Denmark as an artist trying to, you know, get a name for herself. We have a lot of people here working with artists as well. So where does a person like this with minimal to average traction fit into this landscape, and where would you suggest that they start?
It's incredibly difficult, and it's gotten even more difficult. You know, California is unique, and I have the benefit of practicing law exclusively in California. I've been practicing here my whole career, 16 years. As licensed lawyers, you know, you take the bar in one state generally, and that's where you practice. What's unique about California is on the West Coast, we have a lot of sportswear brands, we have a lot of smaller brands. New York tends to be a little bit more the home of the big billion-dollar public companies are based out of New York. So the opportunity to kind of find a few people, friends, make a relationship with someone who's trying to launch something, attach yourself to a brand early on, I would say is probably, to give some optimism, a better opportunity on the West Coast than in New York. Outside of those two, it's very difficult because there just isn't a lot of manufacturing business outside of those two jurisdictions. California actually used to be home to, I'll forget the number, but it was the second largest industry in terms of jobs and hiring in California was the apparel business. Hundreds of thousands of jobs. I mean, it was second. So it was a huge employer in the state of California. All those jobs moved offshore. What happened was, as wages went up, as labor laws, particularly for the garment business, came into effect that were difficult to comply with and ran counter, frankly, to what was really sort of generations of abuse within the industry, all those jobs took off and labor got cheap in first Mexico and then Asia. And now 99% of all garments that are made by California companies are made in Asia. It's done. It just doesn't happen anymore. hundreds of thousands of jobs are gone. So the business has changed here as well. One of the changes is it's design and merchandise, and because people don't own their own sewing factories, you can still have smaller shops that are somewhat undercapitalized that might be looking to partner up with someone and do something. You know, it really becomes then a negotiation of what everyone brings to the table. Mm-hmm. If the artist is interested in the creative elements of a particular brand, that's something that's unique and can be mm-hmm. something to generate a relationship. They want to contribute some money. If they're looking for money back, it's tough with the smaller brands because the one thing they don't have are marketing budgets. So smaller brands, and you'd be surprised, even big, you know, action sports brands here in California, and California's known for the action sports brands, they have small marketing budgets. They can't afford to pay people five, six figures for endorsement deals. They can, you know, the bigger guys can, but the smaller or startup sunglass brands or footwear brands, mm-hmm. What you see is they don't have the money. They can flow some free product. The product generally people like to wear, so you see a lot of those deals just because mm-hmm. people grow up hanging out and having Kenny together, or they surf together, or they skate together, and you know, you strike up a relationship and you start out as an endorser getting free product and maybe $500 a month. Mm-hmm. And maybe you appear at a particular event or not. And there are ways to make that work mutually. You mm-hmm. know, you can get your CD on their website and vice versa. It's just tough.
Started very small.
Very small.
Here's a sort of silly question. Do you get a lot of free shoes doing what you do?
Tons. You have no idea.
That's my kind of job.
Imelda numbers.
Okay. So it's basically the same answer to how do you score a big film. You get to know the director when he's young and developing, right? Because you just don't get gigs like that handed to you or endorsements until you're really famous. So I think it's, again, back to relationships.
Well, the question is, you know, taking a chance on talent, remember that there's a little bit of a divergence there because the entertainment talent, the music talent, it's not a direct fit with some of these brands. I mean, music, they can incorporate music onto their website. They can incorporate some way of getting music a part of their business, but it's not really a primary driver of business for them.
Right.
So it, at best, is a difficult marriage.
Well, if you're Tina Clark, who runs DMI Music and Media in Pasadena, fairly successful boutique brand music brand agency, she says, you know, that music is the emotion that causes people to link the product, and then that has a... And I believe, too, that music is a hugely powerful force that helps people to associate one thing with the other, and it causes an emotional climate and feels good. I mean, the whole music and advertising sector has just grown tremendously in the last 10 years.
Well, I would say, to be optimistic, that as the media platform for these brands goes away from television, which none of them could afford. Mm-hmm. Only the largest billion-dollar public companies have TV ads. I mean, even Billabong and Quiksilver, which reach $1 billion or $1.5 billion in revenue, they've got a couple. It looks like a high school chop shop 30-second mm-hmm. ad, and they run it on Fuel TV at 3 a.m. So network or cable ads that you see, you just don't see it. Big denim companies, they won't do outside of print ads. They're not in media. They're not on television. So as the paradigm changes and they start to use the web quite a bit more, as mobile technology trumps now everything I keep hearing in every media presentation I go to is the entire world will be done on your mobile device in mm-hmm. 5 years. I mean, television will disappear. Everyone's watching things on DVR anyway, or on demand at their own leisure, and that's going to merge into what ultimately will just be your computer screen. But that's an opportunity because, you know, that will need a score. That will need music. Mm-hmm. And products are very, it's old school. The old school being 2D magazine glossy ads. Mm-hmm. That's how the products get sold. Or that's how they get marketed to the extent mm-hmm. that there isn't viral marketing around it. So concerts, events, parties, yes, but it's very 19th century in terms of how it advertises.
Interesting, interesting. Now, let's talk about the lawyer relationship that you generally have. You're representing mostly brands. Have you represented any artists at all?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Recording artists?
I have.
Okay.
So my background is I predominantly represent branded goods companies, mostly in the apparel space, a lot of accessory companies, a lot of footwear companies, some sunglass companies, some energy drink companies, some professionals circulating throughout the those industries, and very West Coast-centric. So it's sportswear brands, denim brands, innerwear, outerwear, juniors, contemporary, a ton of skate and surf brands, which as a surfer and skateboarder is just the neatest thing ever. For me, and I'm outside general counsel for them, so I do whatever they need. And sometimes it's corporate, a lot of times it's contract, a lot of IP. M&A will form the company all the way through when we sell. I'm selling three companies right now.
Really? Okay.
And on the celebrity side, where I've really been fortunate is athletes, actors, and musicians have sort of found, in many ways, that their entertainment lawyers perhaps weren't as well versed in this side of the business, particularly where the entertainer wants to own the brand, develop it themselves, actually be in the brick and mortar business, which is very different than entertainment.
Right.
And so I've been fortunate enough to be able to represent celebrities that have either started brands or are doing deals with some other branded goods companies and try and walk them through some of the nuances of it.
Yeah, this is. Do you ever find yourself sort of semi-agenting, brokering deals?
I try not to.
Okay.
Because inevitably I'm putting client A in touch with client B, and I feel icky doing that. So.
Okay. Because it seems like you would be in a good position to do that.
I can. I just don't. I mean, there are people that do that for a living, and so I try not to hold myself out. I will, as a favor for a friend, if anyone wants me to call someone or do I know someone, sure.
Okay. Interesting, interesting. Let's have a look at this term sheet, which unfortunately you don't have yet. But
this is just a straight license agreement. So this would be no different than, this is a non-entertainment one. So this is just a brand-owning company, a wholesaler, that's looking to license out either its core product, but more likely an ancillary product category that it wants to develop with a really good private label manufacturer within that space. So an apparel company looking to do footwear with a really good footwear company, or a footwear company looking to do a line of related sunglasses.
Okay. So how would this work? There's about 15 or 18 points here. Is this the sort of thing, let me step back a minute. This was intended to be a mock negotiation tonight, but Jen isn't here, so I'm actually just interviewing Greg on the finer points of this deal here. We had created a really great scenario for you with Trixie Delicious and
yes.
her, you know Trixie, right, Greg? Gary, sorry. And her song, Shoes, 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 which is just starting to get some traction. So this is a sort of deal that would be offered by one of your clients to, how would this work?
This is a little bit different. This is a really good primer on the business terms on the manufacturing and distribution side. So what would happen here is if the celebrity wanted to get involved and help design this, let's say.
Okay.
Play more of an active role than just be a brand ambassador.
Okay.
How we would look at some of the different issues, and I thought, without customizing it too much, I just pulled what I would typically do. And I think if you want to go through some of these, I can talk through kind of some of the artful terms or things that come up.
I would like to. So this is, and these are, again, just basically a term sheet. If Trixie Delicious was going to, quote-unquote, get in bed with a manufacturer.
Yes. Well, let's do it like this. If they're going to develop a brand together.
Okay.
Where it gets really interesting and complicated is the current wish list of most celebrities is not just to endorse someone else's product. It's how do we
ownership.
Work together?
Right.
How do we make a new brand? How do we create a diffusion line or something, such and such by Trixie Delicious.
Right.
Kenneth Cole by Trixie Delicious.
Right.
Trixie Delicious for Kenneth Cole. What would that deal look like? Whether we own it together, whether it's a straight license, how do you participate? What creative control do you want, need?
Okay. Joint ventures, do those happen?
Happens a lot.
Okay.
So on the business structure side, obviously the brand is the tension is I don't want to give up any equity. And the artist says, I want equity. And so you always struggle with, do we give up equity day one? Do we give up equity over time? Does it vest? There are tax ramifications of vesting over time, which get slightly esoteric, I'm happy to describe.
Okay.
Is it an actual stock deal versus a phantom stock deal? It's probably worth discussing a little bit of the nuances between actual and phantom stock for the benefit of the audience. So how many people have heard the phrase phantom stock?
Not me.
Okay.
Wow. Sounds interesting.
So phantom stock is in lieu of actual stock. Sometimes a brand owner will say, look, I give you an actual piece of my company, actual shares. Here's what's going to happen. Number one, you're going to have to pay taxes on it. So if I have a going concern that's a $10 or $100 million company and I give you 5% of my business, you actually, as if I gave you a car, you have to pay taxes on the value of that asset the year it's handed to you.
Mm-hmm.
So you haven't paid anything. You haven't done anything. Here's this piece of the company. You have no cash. Go pay taxes on its value. So then I either have to bonus out additional money to pay that tax or the person kind of gets screwed. The second thing I as the brand owner don't want to do in giving out that actual stock is I now give you voting rights. I now give you all sorts of statutory rights as a shareholder to do things. And I owe you a fiduciary duty, which under California law, Delaware law, I just have been doing this for a long time. I'm an entrepreneur. I started this myself. I need to be nimble. I don't want to have partners. I've never had partners. A lot of these brands, it's a solo guy or maybe two people. They're brothers. They've been together generations, you know. They don't want to give away a piece of the company.
Mm-hmm.
So what they say is let's do phantom stock. Phantom stock tries to accomplish the two essential assets that someone gets when they get actual stock, the financial assets. The financial asset of owning stock is if there is a distribution of profits, if I have 5% of the company and the company decides to distribute $100 in profit, I get $5. Now, interestingly, you don't just get the money if the company makes the profit. The company has to decide to distribute that profit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a two-layer, two-level, two-step experience. The second thing that you get when you have that 5% ownership is if I sell the company, you get 5% of the sale proceeds. And you get capital gains treatment on that sale bonus.
Okay.
So what the phantom stock deal is, it says, I tell you what, I'll give you a piece of the sales proceeds if we sell the company, and I may or may not, if we give out profits, distribute it or not, I'll give you a piece, as if you were an owner. So you're not an owner, you don't actually have stock. In our agreement, it says I'm going to give you a monthly stipend, some sort of endorsement fee, $10,000 a month, $100,000 a month. Plus, if I sell the company while you're under contract with us or during a tail period, 10 or 12 to 24 months afterwards,
mm-hmm.
I'll give you 5%. I'll give you 10% of the company. It becomes a contractual right. Bless you. A contractual right as opposed to an actual corporate right. You're not an owner of the shares. But you get the same benefit, theoretically, that an owner would get. But I, the owner, now don't have any partners. I own it 100%.
I like that.
It's a contract, right? It's called phantom stock.
I'm going to put phantom stock for Nero.
Phantom stock.
Yeah.
And you can be very creative with it
because
it's no different than any other contract term. So if I want to say it's 5% of the sales price after I take out a bunch of other expenses, after we pay off this guy, after you've been here for 3 years, it can vest over time. All sorts of different ways. The other interesting thing is it can go away without having to buy back the stock. If I hand you 5%, it's a very complicated transaction later. If, God forbid, you pass away, we want to do something with the company, something happens, I actually have to go out and you own something. I have to buy that back. I might have to sue to enforce a claim. It gets complicated. If it's a contract right that says you just have to be under contract with us, if you screw up and I terminate you under the morals clause or the contract ends, we're done.
Okay.
I don't have to buy it back. There's no tax basis issue that gets complicated. I always own 100%.
Interesting.
So that's actual versus phantom stuff.
Okay.
Learning something here. So walking us through this deal, why don't I start with giving you the layout of our negotiation here, which was brilliantly conceived by myself and Greg. Okay? So we have here Trixie Delicious, who is a young singer-songwriter on the rise from San Diego, California, with a growing number of credits to her name. One of her songs, Shoes, 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 was just licensed to Kenneth Cole for a television commercial, which has garnered thousands of hits to her website and over 90,000 digital downloads. The same track has cracked Billboard Top 200 in the last month. Tastemakers are starting to take notice. Last year, she released her first self-distributed album, which sold 25,000 units, based heavily on sales in college markets of the Southeast. Trixie tours at the club level in the Southwest and does especially well in her hometown area of San Diego, in Phoenix, and in parts of New Mexico. Jen Linus, not here today, but represented by myself, has taken a liking to Trixie, also represented by me, and is handling negotiations for her with the clothing brand Devious, represented by Greg Weissman.
Do you want me to read the Devious one?
Yes.
Okay. I wrote this down. Under the creative direction of Hollywood stylist Elle McZo, Devious is the brainchild of garment industry veterans George and Paul Maraschino, two fashion icons who took the Bordash denim line to $500 million and are now launching various contemporary brands under a holding company formed by them to incubate new and upcoming designer labels. Devious is flirty and sexy, an aspirational label adored by the yachting sect of East Hampton and Cannes. Exclusively at Lisa Klein, Scoop, Barney's, Neiman Marcus, and Fred Siegel, Devious is in its third year of production and looks to cross the $20 million mark in sales with a flagship retail store planned for Robertson Boulevard and Soho.
So it begins, so yes. It begins. Well, it seems like a great match, Trixie and Devious. So does Devious approach Trixie? Would they?
They would probably under this scenario, and they would say, we think you're great.
I am.
Yes. We are looking for a celebrity whose style we like, and our designers think that you have exactly the flair that defines who we are. Now I'm the sales guy, as a lawyer, right? And we want to bring you on, and we want to know, we want to develop a capsule collection with
all
you.
Right.
Actually have signature goods that we're going to sell for a couple of different seasons. And we're going to open a couple of retail stores, and we think that we can combine it with your tour and some meet and greets and in-house stuff or in-store promotions. And, you know, we heard you are very creative, and we thought that offering you an opportunity to launch a new diffusion line would be kind of exciting for you.
That would be very cool. All right. Well, Trixie, my manager is not returning my calls right now, so I'm going to have to handle this on my own. And Jen is not available. So I'm going to be asking Greg a lot of questions here as a semi-informed young singer-songwriter. So Greg, how can we make this happen? Can I get some sort of deal memo from you? How does this work? Do I have to have my manager call you? Where does it go from there?
What I would say is we have an idea of how we think it needs to go.
Okay.
So let's talk through some of those issues, and then we put together a deal memo, and you can run it by your people, agent, manager, whomever, certainly a lawyer, and then we can talk about whether it works for you.
Okay.
You know, a little bit about our brand. Our margins are pretty good. We are at the contemporary level, so we have about a 60-point gross margin.
What does that mean?
It means we sell our wholesale sales price of the goods offers us a 60 gross basis points margin on our cost of goods sold. So if I'm selling goods for $100 to Scoop and Fred Siegel, they cost me 40. Cost of goods sold is an accounting term.
Okay.
So I carry a ton of overhead above and beyond that 40. So I actually pay $40 for that garment. This jacket cost me from China $40, and I will try as a manufacturer to do full package goods. Full package is a term of art in the apparel business that says instead of buying the fabric from Europe, flying it, airing it to Asia, having sewers in Asia cut it, maybe then move it to Thailand to sew it. And I just have one guy in China who says, I've got your specs. I can build you this garment. Here's a sample of this. I'm going to sell it to you. Landed duty paid $40.
We say you're our guy. One stop. Okay.
So package goods. So I've got 60 gross basis points. And the reason why that's critical is I've got some room to actually offer you some money. This is like Ferris Bueller. I have to talking back to the audience.
All right.
The camera. The mid-tier and the lower-tier guys, they're operating in 20 to 40 basis points. They are operating at terrible margins. It's all volume. You can do, Walmart opens you, it's going to be a $30 million order, but you're going to work at you're going to net about 2.5 basis points if you're lucky.
You said 2.5 basis points?
Well, 2.5 points.
Okay.
You're looking to net in the contemporary world about 20%.
Okay.
The owners want to net about 20. So if you start with 60, and then you got rent, salaries, overhead, marketing, trade shows, you name it. And in the first couple of years, that garment costs you $110 that you just sold for $100.
Mm-hmm.
You're losing money. And that's kind of the problem. I think at $20 million, this brand is going to start making some money.
Okay.
The goal would be that the two owners of this brand at $20 million are maybe at the end of the day putting in their pocket, $1 million to $1.5 million.
Okay.
So I've got some money. I can give you a decent royalty on it. We're not in a position to guarantee any royalties anymore because
how do royalties work on this? When let's say I'm very interested, Greg. This sounds great. I want to work with Devious. Let's say we come out with some really sexy shoes or denim jeans. Okay, that just hot. How do royalties work in the fashion world?
Royalties on net sales.
So,
if I sell those goods for $100, I'm going to pay you a percentage of it.
Okay.
I'm going to have a net sales definition that I, as the manufacturer, I feel is a little bit favorable to me. The tension in the net sales definition is I, of course, as the seller of those goods, want to make sure that I'm only paying you on what I get paid.
Right.
Meaning if I invoice $100, but this is a very important topic for mm-hmm. this conversation. I invoice $100, the chances of me getting paid $100 by the retailer is zero. I'm going to get, most department stores take an 8% discount off the top. Just, they call it 8-10 terms. If they pay within 10 days, they take an 8% discount. They take it whether they pay within 10 days or not. They just take it. If you have one barcode incorrectly stamped on any of your boxes, you're going to get hit with a chargeback. If you pack it in poly bags that are folded left instead of folded right, you're going to get hit with a 50 cents a unit chargeback. You are lucky when you ship the majors to get paid 85% of what you think you're going to get paid. The chargebacks and the allowances and the crap and the deals that you have to make, the deal with the devil with these retailers, will eat you alive. And the game within the game, this is not our discussion, mm-hmm. but the game within the game between wholesale and retail is that the retail, because of this consolidation and the lack of available doors, retail owns wholesale right now. Retail can turn around and say, you want your stuff here. So if your stuff doesn't sell, I'm giving it to you back. What do you mean you're giving it to me back? This isn't consignment. I sold it to you. Really? Do you want to sell here next season? Take it all back. You'll take it back. I mean, they call it goods on wheels. You're going to have to supply them with reorders. You're going to have to give them co-op advertising dollars and marketing allowances, all sorts of things that take what used to be this beautiful 60-point gross margin,
mm-hmm.
And we'll just eat it alive.
I was going to ask you, are there returns in the retail world? It sounds like it's much
very
worse.
Few, under 3%.
Well,
in the returns, but it's the allowances and chargebacks that will eat you alive. Some of them, we try and define it to say that when I'm paying you, Trixie.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, if I get hammered either on that invoice or at the end of the season, because the other way that they can take it out of you is they might pay you in full on that invoice, and then you get to the end of the season and they just take your last invoice and say, seasonally it turned out, you had a poor sell through, and we'll pay you half.
That's awful.
Terrible. So what you see, the only thing I can liken it to in the entertainment industry is, if you know a lot about labor law, almost every entertainment company is 100% non-compliant with California labor law. Wage and hour, overtime, meal breaks, they get it all wrong. But God forbid you say anything or sue anybody, you're blackballed and you're out of the industry. So you see, when you see the claims that actually come against the entertainment companies, it's when someone has retired. They're done. They have decided that they're no longer going to work here. They hire a plaintiff's lawyer. They sue. They get a ton of money. Because it's terrible. Same thing that happens here. When companies go out of business and they're in chapter and a trustee gets appointed to go back and go collect all that money, and there's no risk of the brand coming back to do new business because the brand's out of business, they'll get the money. And you sort of see like called the end of the business life cycle lawsuit against the retailer that's been screwing them the whole time.
Okay.
You finally get to punch back against the bully a little bit.
Okay.
Because these chargebacks have no basis in fact.
Okay.
Sometimes they do. Sometimes if you read through the 67-page EDI compliance manual that says, you know, what the box, what size boxes it has to be in, how the box has to be folded, where the UPC is, what color the UPC is, how it's bagged, do the bags stack to the left or the right. I mean, it would boggle your mind, you know. And that's true with all retail. It's true with when you do license stuff with Disney, Mattel, any other big players. There are companies called fulfillment houses. There are third-party fulfillment companies that you can hire if you're a small resource. And a lot of times these smaller brands who don't want to pay for their own warehousing, don't understand all that very complicated morass of rules and regulations, they'll hire a third-party company, a fulfillment house, that actually says, we do all that for you. We'll take your goods in from the dock. You tell us where they need to go. We will pick, pack, and ship, meaning we'll take a stack of 100 yellow shirts, three to Barney's, three to Fred Siegel, three to whomever. We'll put them in the boxes. We'll pack them correctly, and we'll ship it for a fee.
Okay.
That was a very complicated little lesson on
This is all new to us, so this is great. So, Mark's proprietary licensed. Okay, and the words in such stylized forms that are designated from time to time.
So, well, I think what we should probably talk about is when we're developing a new brand. It always gets tricky. You know, if it's Devious by Trixie Delicious, it's pretty easy. We know that Devious is going to own the Devious component, and Trixie Delicious is going to Trixie Delicious component.
Right.
If we develop a brand together, Fetish by Eve or something, we create a brand, and there's all sorts of precedent for an artist actually creating a particular new name, who gets to own it? And that's a critical issue, because if I give you any ownership of that trademark, of that asset, the principal asset you sell at the end of a business life cycle, if I sell a branded goods company, I sell Juicy Couture, I sell Lamb, I sell whatever, you're selling the trademark. Because at the end of the day, the inventory is already spoken for, and it's going to move through in its own cycle. If I sell something for $100 million, I'm selling the trademark and its attendant goodwill for $100 million, basically. Racks, computers, it's de minimis.
Okay.
So if I give you a piece of it, I'm vesting you, I'm staking you pretty heavily at the very beginning.
Okay.
I don't want to do that.
Okay.
I may do it for something that I don't really feel is my primary house mark. If I'm creating a capsule collection with you that I'm not sure where it's going to go, maybe we'll split it 50-50. Now, the problem, of course, is if I have an endorsement relationship with you that lasts a finite term, I'm now married to you in business forever because you're going to own it with me forever, whether our relationship, our contractual relationship, is done or gone.
Okay.
So I'm nervous to want to give you those rights.
All right. So something to very much ask for and fight for.
Well, what I'm probably going to do is give you some phantom stock.
Okay.
And say, I'll tell you what the right answer is in this tension. It is, you know what, you're right. If we develop it together and it gets big and it's time to sell it, you should participate. Absolutely. You've helped get us there. And so if we sell it, I'll give you half the money. But if you're gone, and 5 years later, when it's still, you know, we use Fetish by Eve, and there's no Eve anymore, and the Fetish brand has done very well, but you've been gone for 5 years, is it fair to pay you any money? I could argue, you could argue that you helped build whatever goodwill in those first formative years.
Right.
And I'm going to say that, yeah, but, you know, you took it to $10 million, I took it to $100 million, and it was my capital risk. That's all my money. What happens at the end of the day is you're funding production. You are lean. You are constantly borrowing. You're not taking out money. These garment guys, it's very difficult to take out money because as you are funding a $1 million business, it becomes a $2, a $3, a $5 million business. If I had to buy $400,000 worth of goods, remember, to sell $1 million in product on my 60-point margin, when I get to $10 million, it costs me $4 million. So I have to now pay the Chinese contractor $4 million. I ship two or three times a year, maybe four. So my cash flow is terrible because I'm not getting money every month. I get it a couple times a year.
Right.
And I have to take all those dollars that I'm now making on the sales and plow them back into my own growth.
Okay.
So it's very difficult for me other than to maybe pay a decent salary for myself, put my kids through school. They always lease fancy cars for themselves. But you are still this close to bankruptcy because you're taking all that money and plowing it back into your business to buy new product.
Right. Well, Greg, I feel for you and your client. That's great. I understand very much so. As an artist, I have that same struggle, yes. But as I say to everybody, whether as Tess or Trixie, I think ownership is important.
Yes.
So we'll table that and move on to the next deal point. But
okay.
I like the phantom stock solution.
Sure.
That's very creative. So territory, does this sort of thing typically happen worldwide or just start in the U.S. or regionally?
Well, it really depends on what each party brings to the table. So
okay.
in an endorsement relationship, it's going to be worldwide. I'm going to want to have rights all over the place.
Okay.
Where it gets tricky is when you're merging existing brands, existing talents, and there may be trademark dispute
okay.
issues, which are all regional. Trademarks, by the way, this gives me an opportunity to talk about trademarks for a second. So trademarks are all jurisdictional. Trademarks, if you have a trademark that's created in the United States, your rights end at the border. You need to go out and independently register your brand in every country of the world in order to have rights. The U.S. is interesting and unique because it is the only jurisdiction that is a first-to-use jurisdiction, meaning a registration is what gets you rights in every other country. In the U.S., it's you slapping that label on goods and selling them. So I often say to my clients, especially ones without 5 cents in their pocket, go out and put your name, go do a search, do it online yourself, hire a lawyer if you have the money to hire a lawyer. If the name looks good, cross your fingers, put the brand on the goods and go. Because at the end of the day, you can't even register a mark until you've actually shown use. You still at some point in the United States end up taking a chance at putting your goods on the market for which you could be liable for infringement in order to be granted trademark rights in the U.S. In other countries, you just go out and you file.
Okay.
But it's important to mention because trademark rights are jurisdictional. A lot of people don't know that.
Okay.
It's not like copyright. And I know that, in the music world, it's copyright driven.
Mm-hmm.
Should I do 2 seconds on trademark law?
Sure.
Okay.
Go ahead.
This is a huge issue in the branded goods business. Trademarks... Sorry about the difference between trademark and copyright. So copyrights are all about original works of authorship in a fixed medium. Copyright works very well for music, as you know, fine art, books, film. Again, the two elements of copyright are originality and something being reduced to a fixed medium, whether it's the art, the music, it's recording, whatever. Trademark is all about source identification. It is purely about what does the public perceive the source of those goods to be. It's a brand. It's an identity. And it can take many different forms. Mostly it's words, but it can be a color, like Owens Corning for pink fiberglass. It can be the Coke bottle, the shape of the Coca-Cola bottle. It can be, in the fashion world, the Burberry plaid, which all other plaids are not capable of trademark protection unless they develop some secondary meaning. This design or what have you,
mm-hmm.
these stripes. But when you see a Burberry garment, you know it's Burberry. And you know it's Burberry because they always use that same plaid on everything they've ever made for 100 years. Levi's has a very robust set of trademark rights in the garment industry that extend down to... Levi's actually owns the right to the vertical tab on the front pocket of any men's shirt is Levi's. You will not see a vertical hanging tab pocket on the front. That's something they developed about 10 years ago, which is interesting because they were the purveyors of the rights on the back pocket.
Okay.
100 years ago, they're the ones that have their double arcuate stitch, you know, the little V stitch in the back. God forbid you have any pocket stitch that remotely looks close to Levi's and you'll get a letter.
Okay.
I haven't had a funny situation with one of my clients. Levi's will send out batches of letters and I get this letter and I look at my pocket or my client's pocket and Levi's pocket. And I said, I called the lawyer up and said, I got to tell you, I see your thing. I see our, I don't see it. And he said, oh, no. It's just ours upside down. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. I mean, by yours upside down, as in not yours at all. And he didn't like that. But that's sort of the nature of how Levi's tends to operate, which is any stitch that could remotely be deemed similar. In this case, the standard is called likelihood of confusion.
Okay.
Which is a very broad and amorphous standard for infringement. Likelihood of confusion is, God only knows what a federal court judge in downtown LA is going to say.
Well, I think
confusing.
It's worth noting that in the music business, one of the most important trademark issues is in the name of the band.
Yes.
That's where you get real into a lot of trouble, especially if there's a band, a pre-existing band, or one that's partially disbanded but not quite active, but used to be in the 60s. And I've seen this sort of thing happen. You know, when I worked at MCA Records in the legal department, we had a couple of those trademark issues, and they're hairy and expensive.
Yes.
And annoying.
My clients, Blink-182, were Blink for a long time until they had a dispute and became Blink-182.
Yeah, I actually remember that. Yes, okay.
So these conflicts come up all the time. Searching the trademark, dealing with it, which company, you know, between the two of us is going to go spend the time to search a new mark, to go out and register a new mark. One of the problems is if I don't want to develop a new brand and you really want to develop a new brand and we talk about that, I will tell you that, look, at my revenue level right now, I don't have a ton of extra money for legal. If you give me a new brand and you tell me this is how it happens sometimes with an over-exuberant artist, especially an established artist who says, we're going to go do this, we're going to do handbags, they won't stop talking about all the things they want to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of those goods in each one of those countries is an independent cost.
Right.
And I could be, have a trademark portfolio of 40 different, in 40 countries, two marks on three sets of goods in 40 different countries could be $300,000 in legal fees. So it's very daunting. I need to temper a lot of times. It's the opposite. I'm tempering the exuberance and enthusiasm of the artist to say, let's just keep it in the U.S. I want rights to use you wherever in case I want to expand. But this is my capital risk, and I can't afford to go spend that kind of money to flesh out these marks unless it merits it.
Okay. Well, let's just say we've agreed on jeans. We're going to start in the U.S. Renewal term, contract years. What do these? Are these deals short? Do they tend to be
Option
periods? How does this work?
What happens is when you're developing goods with another company, the company that's granted the right to use your trademark, they want it as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing they want is to develop goods for you, pay you a royalty, build that business for you, and have you take it away at the end. So they're going to want successive renewal terms as long as they possibly can get it. I'm going to want to tie you up as long as I possibly can at my election, as long as I don't have to pay you guaranteed royalties.
Okay.
The flip side is if this becomes you demanding a guaranteed minimum royalty on sales every year that I think is a little aggressive, I'm going to say that sounds great, but at some point, if the sales aren't there, this isn't working for me, and I've got to cut my losses.
And that probably wouldn't work for an undeveloped artist or not as established. It might work for Trixie.
It might work for Trixie.
She would certainly ask for it.
She might.
Okay, she would.
Yes. What's interesting is there's a development period. Depending on what the goods are, outerwear is an example, which is a one-season-a-year business. You're developing stuff right now for, it's winter 2013.
Okay.
In footwear and apparel, it's generally 6 to 9 months out. It can be sometimes longer if it's a better price point. So we may do this, and if you, for example, demand immediate monthly money starting today, it's 6 months before we have samples. We sell those goods. We design it. We approve it. We love it. We go to market with it 6-8 months from now. We take orders for it for 12-14 months from now. I ship 14 months from now. I get paid 60 days later. I'm now 18 months out before I get my first dollar return on it. And I'm paying the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. and I'm developing. I'm going, and if it's footwear, it's molds in China. It's a lot of different expense. If it's apparel, mm-hmm. it's a little mitigated because of these full package guys now that will bust them down the door to try and do that work. But it's still a long lead time that's critical for my business.
Okay, one stop, basically. Okay, so this is all very interesting, and I'm trying to relate it as much as possible to the music, to what I know, you know, in a regular license agreement. A permitted distribution channel. I haven't seen that language, a permitted distribution channel.
So this comes up all the time.
Okay,
so a huge tension in the consumer goods business, especially the fashion business, is where do you sell these goods? And the tension is always the person who has no interest in the brand. If I'm a private label manufacturer, for example, and I just make sunglasses. And sunglasses mm-hmm. are a great example because a lot of these private label sunglass manufacturers, if you did research on them, you'd find out that they sell, the same company makes and sells $200 Gucci stuff, $400 Gucci stuff, $150 Anne Klein esque stuff, $70 Ralph Lauren, and the $20 drugstore stuff. It's one company, and they're selling all four tiers of that distribution. So from their perspective, they want to move as many products as they possibly can. And they know at the end of the day, the downstairs market is where you move volume. So they are...
Downstairs market.
Meaning
okay.
the lower price points.
Got it.
They're going to move much more product down there.
But she'll never get back up again.
That's right.
According to your earlier theory.
And what's interesting is, so we talk about distribution channels. Brand owners can't stand it. Brand owners say, look, the brand integrity is, we're back to that old business idiom. Mm-hmm. If it's an upstairs brand, I got to keep it upstairs. I can't have you selling it at the swap meets. I can't have you selling it at the gas stations. I can't have you selling it if it's a better contemporary brand. I'm going to even tell you on a pure per retail store basis where you can and can't sell. I want to look at your retailer list. I want to look at your distribution and tell you.
Okay, wow.
A lot of celebrities, we see this now with a lot of stylists. A lot of stylists have gone into the branding business. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so-and-so styles for so-and-so. And the stylist will develop a brand. I work with Katie Holmes and her stylist. They have a brand called Holmes and Yang. And it's sold exclusively at Maxfield and very high-end stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once you sell at that price point, for example, you're never going to take it downstairs at all. If, for example, they were to bring in some branded goods company to do the handbags, to do any of the ancillary product, man, the first thing that that guy's going to want to do is, how do I move that product downstairs? And what happens to me at the end of the season, this dovetails into off-price goods.
Right, that was my next question.
What happens at the end of the season when we're sitting on inventory? We talked about the production cycle and the fact that you can never fully rely upon pre-booked orders for your inventory. Different things get made at different paces, and you need to ship on certain dates. And so to me, and I'm just the lawyer on the outside, it boggles the mind trying to figure out how these production people within these brands can get their calendars straight.
Mm-hmm.
But their calendars, they get up in the morning and they have, you know, as big as that screen, it's the production calendar. Every date, and when do we have to ship Nordstrom, and when do we have to ship Bloomingdale's, and then they work backwards and figure out, okay, well, you know, this piece will be done here, the matching bottoms won't be done until here, and how do we make all that work?
Mm-hmm.
You over-order stuff. You're going to order a little extra in case it sells through and you've got reorders. Then you're stuck with stuff. Now, the business people will say it's dollar bills on hangers. You've got to move it because you've spent money to buy those goods. Just keeping it because you think that maybe a year or two from now the fashion will recycle and you can sell it again at full wholesale, it's a disaster. We talked about how lean these businesses are, how they're constantly dealing with the fact that every dollar that they're earning on sales they're putting back into production. They can't afford to sit on a lot of inventory.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have banks or factors. So you have these asset-based lenders that have lent against that inventory, and they're going to require that inventory to be sold. So what are you going to do? You sell to Ross, Marshalls, TJ Maxx, which is all one company, by the way. It's called Marmaxx.
What a surprise. Okay.
And so Marmaxx is going to buy your goods, or you'll sell, if it's lower-end stuff, to Soriano and a bunch of Mexican closeout companies. You will sell to there's a European Walmart that's slightly different. I mean, I'm trying to learn. I represent a couple of off-price guys. The goods either go, you know, Marmaxx domestically, two or three big retailers in Mexico. There's this interesting Canadian one, or, you know, make the goods disappear.
So basically the brand does not want to permit stuff to sell.
That's right.
Okay.
So the brand will put in contractual provisions talking about how, placing a limit on it.
Okay.
And it will literally say at some point when you've sold over your quota, you got to burn it. It's done. You got to destroy it. Where it gets really interesting is if you've ever wondered about the product mix at Marmax, a lot of that product is actually special cuts. Special cuts means those manufacturers are developing first-run merchandise for those stores. It's not just something that was at Bloomingdale's that didn't sell that ended up back on the rack and they shipped it to Ross. They developed that product for Ross.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cheaper price point, it's a cheaper fabric, it's a cheaper whatever. They're self-knocking themselves off
mm-hmm.
because their margins at those stores are fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Everything sells at Marmax. So a big tension is often when you're licensing out a brand, particularly with these private label manufacturers,
mm-hmm.
that they actually can make money downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
So their goal is to try and make product for Marmax. So it's a real word to the wise when you're dealing with a celebrity or someone else to talk seriously about the distribution channels, to use the phrase off-price. Where are you selling your off-price goods? What are your what's your closeout
mm-hmm.
Business model? What do you do? And negotiate something.
Now, you've talked about seasons, too, which I guess the only season in the music business is Christmas, you know, the holidays when sales are pumping up. What are the seasons in fashion and what happens or doesn't happen?
Well, it changes. It's just
okay.
Ship cycles. So,
okay.
You know, retail stores don't like to buy product every week. They want to turn goods on various weekly or monthly cycles.
Okay.
The wholesaler generally can get sales records that are real time. They can see exactly how many small green sweaters sold at Nordstrom's in Seattle that month.
Okay.
Or that day, rather. And seasonally, you design for, it's three big ones, and arguably it's like up to six or eight. It's
mm-hmm.
it's spring, summer, sort of one, but you can split it up to summer one delivery, summer two delivery, spring one,
okay.
spring two. So spring, summer, fall, and holiday.
Okay.
There's also resort, it's a little other tricky ones, but effectively it's those three.
Okay.
So you generally work on a three or four season development cycle. Your ship deliveries will be 6 to 8 times a year, but it's 3 to 4 seasonal developments. Outerwear once a year, swimwear generally once a year. So there are exclusions to it.
I want to ask one last question before we take a quick break here. Is I'm asking you to switch hats from representing the brand and the manufacturer now to if you were...
Trixie's lawyer?
If you were Trixie's lawyer, well, no... I'm asking you to step outside of your role as the brand representative and tell us honestly, what do you think is the best deal a Trixie could get from your client?
Dollars and cents?
Yeah, and term, dollars and cents, the best terms she could get, an artist of this stature.
I will tell you that no one's guaranteeing dollars to someone of her status.
Okay.
You're just not seeing it.
You're not really seeing advances or stuff like that, okay.
No. She is probably lucky to get in the 3 to 6% royalty range.
Okay.
Depending on where the goods are sold. The biggest, best names are going to get 10, sometimes 12.
Mm-hmm.
The highest royalty rate I've ever seen for music-related stuff is there was a company for a while that had all the licenses for all the 70s and 80s rock bands,
mm-hmm.
60s, 70s, and 80s rock bands. One company... And they're doing T-shirt graphics only. So T-shirts cost nothing to make, and
mm-hmm.
you can sell them for a ton of money. There's a ton of margin.
Mm-hmm.
Even, 70, 80-point margin. I mean, just crazy.
Yeah.
And they were getting 15%.
Okay.
So if you wanted to do the Rolling Stones 1972 Hot Lips Tour, whatever it was, shirt, you know, it was 15 points.
Okay.
Generally, you see three on a wider mass market kind of deal.
Okay.
Six, maybe eight... percentage points on more of a better, a mid-tier to better or
okay.
contemporary branded goods deal. And it's always going to change. So what's going to happen is the guys will say, you know, it's 8 points, but, you know, PacSun, Pacific Sunwear takes a huge discount. We sell a lot of goods to PacSun. I need to do 5% at PacSun because they take an extra 3 that I don't get.
Okay.
Or if I have a closeout sale to Target and it's purely, or to Ross, and it's purely closeout
mm-hmm.
goods, it's really end-of-season stuff. I'm losing money on it. I should pay you 2% on closeout goods. So you're going to get a discounted rate for closeout goods, maybe a discounted rate per particular retailers that demand a discount themselves. I might pay you a monthly fee to come do some appearances and in-store stuff. I might do that as a fee in addition to those royalties, or a fee as an advance against the royalties. My goal would probably say, why don't I give you, you know, a minimum guaranteed a minimum number of, you know, $5,000 a month. I'm not going to pay a ton of money.
And if
I give you a piece of the company or the trademark,
that would be great.
I'm going to tip off, I'm going to make you buy it.
Okay.
Because what I'm going to say is, I gave you equity in my company that you didn't have to invest in.
Okay.
And if my company's worth $20 million, you know, if I give you 5%, technically I just gave you $4 million.
Sort of a part B question, which
no,
you just
got my math wrong, but
no.
Yeah, thank you.
Are there would it fall under this kind of deal where the artist would say tour the retail outlets, or would that, I mean, would there be performance dates specified?
That would be the best harmony between a musical artist and a brand would be, are you touring? If you're touring, how can we work together? Am I going to get, I'm going to pay you a lot more money if you can co-brand for me.
Okay.
If you're touring and on all your collateral, my brand ends up on all your tour, your website, on, you know, all meet and greet, step and repeat kind of stuff. If the back of, I don't know, on your tour bus.
Right.
I know we just did, the Blink guys just did the Honda Civic tour. You know, Honda was obviously very prominently featured as a sponsor of that tour, to the point of naming rights. So if I were to get those type of rights in association with you, I would pay heavily for them. But I'm going to pay market for that, very likely.
And what is market?
Well, depends what it is. I don't know.
What could Trixie get for that sort of thing?
I have no idea how many.
Okay.
I have no idea.
All right. Well, tell you what. We're going to take a break, and I'm going to consult with my lawyer.
Please.
And come back to discuss your proposal.
Sure.
So we're going to take a quick break, become very briefly intermittent. If you need to use the restrooms, they're upstairs and in that corner. We'll see you back here in about 9 minutes. All right. Thank you. All right, everyone, we are back for the second part of our discussion of sponsorship endorsement deals here with young Greg Weissman, champion surfboard skater and attorney. So I have a million questions, but I want to turn the floor over to you, my good people. If you have questions, we're going to have you step forward to the microphone. Is this positioned in a good way? All right, so Susie, you will disappoint me if you don't have questions. Cameron, you will disappoint me. Tony, Michael, Sine. Okay, Tony, would you mind stepping up here?
We can just repeat it back.
If you want. Just shout
it out. Sure, if it's short.
Yeah, what are the typical restrictions on the artist selling their equity stake?
The typical restrictions on the artist selling his equity stake.
There's absolutely going to be a right of first refusal for the company to buy it back. And depending on, and it's really no different with any partnership agreement, the owners don't want to see these assets out on the open market. They want an opportunity to buy it back first. So whether that's at a pre-negotiated price, yet another reason why the brands will generally opt for phantom stock and not actual stock is they don't want to run the risk that someone's going to put it out on the open market. One, there's a risk they could sell to a competitor, which it's pretty rare for that to happen. Or two, that they just don't want to deal with someone who isn't the very individual that they want to give that piece to.
Cameron.
Good question.
Come on over here. Yes, very good question. Cameron Rafferty.
Yes. So you mentioned the brand ambassadors earlier, how some people are like, I don't want to deal with the hassle. I don't want to, you know, here, use my name, pay me a royalty, no matter how that works. There's a lot of people that know that, you know, their star could be great in this economy, at this date, in this time, right now. But in a year from now, they might release an album that flops. Or they tour, or they're touring Europe, or they're not touring the United States, and this season released their summer collection. Are there people that actually, brand ambassadors, so to speak, that go, okay, you want to release a jacket or a shirt, put my name on it, and just pay me a royalty per what you've sold? Are there people that are actually just like, just go ahead and like almost a like consignment deal with attaching their name to the actual article of clothing or whatever? Are there people that just kind of do that for one season, don't worry about phantom stock or anything?
There are. So there's a continuum, really, between an artist that's just interested in making a few dollars on a sponsorship or an endorsement deal for a finite period of time, which is, hey, I will be the face of Ann Taylor for a season. I will do, you know, I'll be the face of in cosmetics. It happens all the time. And that's just a personality rights license, which is the brand says, I'm going to use you, your rights of personality, name, likeness, biography, image, signature, biographical information in connection with these products for this amount of time, for this royalty rate, or this flat fee, or this advance against. With my option to maybe renew, I may or may not add 1 to 3, 5, 10 personal appearances, depending on your schedule, and we're done. That's a straight endorsement deal. So on the continuum between that kind of just show me the money deal, and I, the artist, fancy myself a designer. I'm Gwen Stefani. I actually want to design clothes. I want to design. I want to have a lifestyle line, not just clothes. I want to do a full lifestyle line, no different than Kenneth Cole. But I'm actually a singer. I have a band, no doubt. Mm-hmm. I have my solo stuff. I've been very successful. I don't need the money. There's just a lot of downtime between tours and records, and this is what I think I'm really good at. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to take my own money, my own capital, and actually invest it and either do it myself. I represent Travis Barker. Travis, 12 years ago, decided, well, Blink was actually kind of in its heyday. I'm going to start a clothing company, and it's his capital. It's his money. He's hired his friends. It's in Corona, where he's from, out in the Inland Empire. And started making clothes, and he didn't know how to make he had no idea the process. But he, sunk money into it, didn't do well, sunk money into it again next season, season after that. And he actually owns a brand no different than two people out of design school that borrow some money or get an SBA loan and rent a facility in Vernon, which is where all this stuff happens, Huntington Park, Vernon, middle of nowhere. And make and sell clothes. So between the straight endorsement, put my name on goods, I don't even care what they look like, pay me the money, to the I'm going to own it and control every element of it, you have this huge continuum. And,
sure.
And so it's actually difficult to try and figure out how this would get structured, mm-hmm. because it really starts with what the artist says is, what do you want? What do you want to do? And if you want to do the one, I can do the one. That's easy. If you want to develop something together, we can do that together. And if you want to own the whole thing yourself with all of your money and you just need me to manufacture your goods because you don't really know the business yet, we can do something on the short term and I'll make goods for you.
Okay.
The reason that I asked that question was because, a lot of people probably feel, and I'm making an assumption, and you know what assuming means, but I'm making the assumption that, a lot of people are not the Gwen Stefanis, and, a lot of artists, for example, you get a label deal and you pop up for a year and a half. And in this market, it's sell it as quick as you can, because as soon as that album fades, your sophomore album is really going to be the determinant of whether you're going to do well or not. I was just thinking from a perspective of an independent artist at this point, what if a lot of the big name artists now that have kind of arisen to popularity in the past year talk with their labels and figure out how they have to, what they have to figure out with the labels go, well, how could we increase our marketing dollars in this economy since the labels aren't giving us, labels aren't marketing as much as they would now as they were in a better economy? How can I get more bang for my buck by getting more exposure into the market by being a hot artist with one single that's going to be there?
It's a great question. It's going to throw our negotiation on its ear, because what it's going to say is, I, the artist, need to market myself.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of being very aggressive as an artist and saying, give me all this money, mm-hmm. the artist is going to say, I need to sell albums. I need to sell, and how in the world can I pair myself with other people? I'm not going to worry about the dollars from this relationship. I want to know what ancillary benefit my record, my exposure, my record's going to get. And so what can we do together? You can put an MP3, like a 3-inch CD, DVD on your hang tags. We can do things where you end up on my website and my goods, and I'm at trade shows. I have presence where if I can get you on every hang tag, on every garment that I sell, that's going to add value for you.
Exactly.
Get your name out there.
Exactly.
So in a weird way, it bets against the economics of the relationship that the artist is usually seeking, which is what are you going to pay me?
Exactly.
Their response is, how do we work together? But I think there's a lot of symbiosis to emerging artists because and these smaller brands, they each need each other a little bit. So
true, absolutely.
It might not be a dollar deal. This might be just let's go out and mutually expose each other for the marketing benefit of it.
Mm-hmm. How often is that happening these days?
It happens a lot. The one constant is the dollars aren't there to pay people.
Exactly.
So unless you're a top-level celebrity that's going to bring instantaneous recognition that there's fair market value for, if you don't do it with me, you're going to do it with Kenneth Cole, whomever. It's about being really creative, as you're talking about, and trying to figure out how we can work together. I do a ton of collab deals now for streetwear brands in L.A. that just find a really cool graffiti artist or a band or a retail store. Just they want to kind of match vibe. I like your vibe. I like your vibe. How do we work together? Let's do a couple of T-shirts. And streetwear business is all T-shirt-driven and printables, hats, fleece, mm-hmm. and T-shirts. And you design 2 shirts for me. It's just T-shirts. It's your art, and we're going to market it together. We're going to do 2 or 3 product drops. We'll go to a couple stores together. You'll perform at a store opening or a trade show, and we'll try and generate some buzz that way. Basically, if you put my brand on every album that you sell and I put your song on my website and maybe your picture on every hang tag that I sell, we're creating instantaneous marketing for each other. It doesn't cost anything other than the development cost. So that's what you do see. You see people being creative mm-hmm. and kind of dollar-free or royalty-free relationships.
Very
Does that
nice.
Make sense?
Thank you, Cameron.
Right on.
Anyone else? Tara? Gary? Do you mind? Okay.
How does the branding company deal with the artist's value that they see in themselves bringing to the table, which is impossible to quantify, obviously, and I understand the work-together model, but when you're coming to a situation where you're giving, whether it's the Phantom stock or any other of these kinds of things, how do you value that?
It's so hard. It's easy if it's a percentage of sales because it becomes just a calculation based upon margin that you have available. I pay my sales reps 8, 10, or 12% of the goods. I have money available to pay as a percentage of sales, which is kind of a no risk because I'm not guaranteeing anything. If the stuff doesn't sell, then we both lose. If the stuff sells, we both win. And I can pick a number that I know won't, from a unit standpoint, be a problem. Throwing money out into the wind as an advance or a guarantee is really difficult. I'll tell you what usually happens. The really good big companies, they never bet. They never guess. They'll get on the phone with the retail buyers and say, I got Jessica Simpson. We're going to develop something with her. What's your tolerance? What are your open to buy dollars? And they will start working already with the retailers to figure out how much product they can sell. And they are already, there's such gamesmanship going on with the buyer, and they're already playing games because last season we oversold, undersold, you owe me a few bucks here, I owe you a few bucks there, and they kind of plug it into a formula where they mitigates against that economic risk. The other thing is they just have a throwaway budget. They just figure out at the beginning of the year, the marketing department, I'll give you, X dollar. I'm going to give you $600,000. You want to have a band? You want to have a party? You want to have a trade show? You want to hire Jessica Simpson? What do you want to do? Here's your budget. Go spend it. And makes, tanks, whatever. It's fixed based upon the sales that they think they can do. So The easy answer is if it's just a percentage-based proposition, I plug it into what I know I have available that won't kill me, and then we both take that risk. It is tough to quantify. It really is. There are historical models, I guess. I've never seen anyone say, and I did a deal a couple of years ago with a singer that came to a skate footwear company, and they said, this singer, you know, all the skaters love her, and let's pioneer, even though skaters tend to be kind of unique and not want to do stuff that's too commercial or too popular culture. Let's develop something around her, and that deal actually fell through because my client had no tolerance for risk, and as the guaranteed money kept going up, they said, I just can't do this. I can't commit those types of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
With athletes, it's interesting because let me give you a corollary that's important. Nike, Adidas, Reebok, you know, these guys kind of know what the range is to pay NBA and NFL athletes. And they make a ton of money, so that they're so profitable. Their marketing departments are huge. They will throw money at people because they kind of know, based upon past experience, what the such and such shoe has sold, or what previous years of Jordan's too high, but you know, the last Kobe Bryant shoe or Dwayne Wade, and they probably is a baseline statistic analysis that they can do and figure it out. You asked the right question because it came down to, I don't know what the deal is yet. I don't know. You know, the asking price is what a willing buyer and a willing seller are willing to do. Small brands don't have these budgets. The easy answer is the percentage-based deal because if we both make it work, we both get rich.
Okay.
You can't really market a Bruno Mars shoe.
You know, he's so hot right now. It's like, I don't know. I'm sure you'll see, and I don't know any, other than just knowing how hot he is right now, you know, to me, it's get him a hat deal. What's his signature
exactly,
look?
Yeah.
Is the fedora.
Exactly. Yeah.
So someone, and he's just, he's cool enough right now with that kind of jazz club cool, and as the men's tailored clothing goes back to a little more of a 60s, small, like a tighter silhouette, a thinner tie, I could see one of the big suit companies just snatch him up and say, he's our guy. What you see is people generally, you know, who do we think is us? Who do we think sells us? Who gets us from an aesthetic standpoint? And then they go grab him, and then the lawyers try and work out the economics of it. But I, you asked the right question. I don't know the answer.
Okay.
You know.
Any more questions? Charlie, would you mind coming down to the mic? No? You don't want to? No. You've got a bad leg. Oh, we could bring the mic down. Good.
Or I can repeat the question.
Yeah, we'll do that.
With the trends that have been happening in the business, credit markets and all those kind of things, have you seen that there's been a diminished kind of a deal for musical artists? Because, hey, you're only as good as your last hit.
It's interesting.
I guess let's repeat the question. Has there been a diminished interest in music artists?
Not only from that perspective, but as far as any kind of backing participation with regards to the fan stock, or we're not so sure about you, so we're going to go ahead and hold back what we're going to pay into this until we see that things happen.
Well, the crazy thing is musicians are different than other celebrities because musicians are creative. And no disrespect to the actors and the acting community, but they're reading someone else's lines.
Exactly.
And I have just such a deep respect for musicians. Musicians have slept in a van. And every successful artist in music has slept in a van. And it just, those are the people I want to work with. You're interested, they have their own style generally. They're not... I don't know any musician that's truly adorned by a stylist that they wake up, they dress themselves. It's who they are, and that's why they're successful. And because of that, as they do these deals with these branded goods companies, they always want to develop something. And because they want to develop something and it's something new and they attach themselves, it's deeper than just that straight endorsement from my perspective. And so we can get creative and fun with it. And I'm going to, of course, you know, look at the immediacy of the value that they provide and try and judge how we should pay them accordingly. Lesser artists who have had trouble, whose name recognition is diminished, which is your question, intuitively I would say that they would demand, they're not going to be able to get as high of a royalty or a number. Because the question is, I got to be able to sell goods. And so my first question is, what are the consumers going to buy? And to me, the math is all done at the consumer level. You want to bring to me someone from Jefferson Starship. God, you know, people love that band, but who's going to buy that product right now? How do I brand that? What possibly do I do? You bring me, you know, someone from 30 Seconds to Mars, Jared Leto, or people that are all over the media. Ironically, a lot of times, celebrity can be defined not by what they do on stage, but who they are. I mean, Tommy Lee could probably get all sorts of deals and had got all sorts of deals because of what he was able to do on television, separate and apart from who he was in the crew. Different than, you know, Mick Mars is going to. It's also, who are you? And do you, can you sell goods? And, you know, you don't have to be currently selling albums to have a style persona that people want to emulate and want to buy product from. I mean, interestingly, we talked about Gwen Stefani several times. No Doubt hasn't had an album in 6-8 years. They're trying to finish their studio album, which they haven't done yet. Perry Farrell has great style. As Jane's new album comes out, I bet you he'll see some deals with him. Dave Navarro has very interesting style, but no one's picked up any deals with him. It's funny, you probably see fewer deals with musicians than you do with actors and actresses whose agents are constantly looking to get endorsement deals, because as people on television, all they, you know, smiling and reading someone else's line is their day job, so how hard is it to do that, to plaster their picture on stuff?
The deals that you're seeing, are they coming from, or they're approaching you, are they coming from record companies as they're trying to find different revenue streams within the 360?
No.
William Morris Endeavor?
The question is, where are the deals coming from, record companies?
Well, let me tell you one of the things that I've observed that's happening. So the agencies are trying to pick up ancillary revenue, and they don't know how to do it.
The artist agencies?
They don't know how to do it because their primary business is getting actors and writers, actors, directors, movie and TV gigs, and getting musicians, record deals, and touring deals. And they, this crazy world of products, they have the world's best Rolodexes, and there's a certain confidence bordering on arrogance that they have that they can do anything. That I wouldn't be surprised to hear that CAA bought a hotel chain. I mean, there's nothing they think they can't do. They bought a clothing company. CAA bought a clothing company this year. It's doing well. CAA developed as an affiliate venture capital fund called Star Avenue Partners or Star Avenue Capital that bought J Brand. J Brand probably being the then current hottest denim brand in LA a year ago, 2 years ago. They bought either a 50% or a majority stake for $40, $60, $80 million.
Mm-hmm.
What was new, novel, and kind of tectonic about that was that when were agencies in the business of owning brands? They have lifestyle divisions that they've started and have fumbled with, frankly. They fumbled with them because it's a different cast of characters. And these deals are different. And, you know, whether it's the garment business, the handbag business, it's not in Beverly Hills. It's in Vernon, Huntington Park, City of Commerce, City of Industry. They don't even want to drive there. I mean, I had a meeting in City of Industry Wednesday at 3 o'clock. I mean, it took me like an hour and a half, you know, to get to City. I don't want to go to City of Industry, let alone, you know, Ari Emanuel wanting to go to City of Industry. And it's just so different from what they do. It's not in their bailiwick. So they haven't really gotten it right. But they're trying to, because One of the things that's unique about the fashion business is it's kind of sexy and it's kind of cool. And for there's this weird kind of big brother, little brother relationship between entertainment and the fashion business, because it's just cool enough that it looks like, hey, I'm an actor. I think I can design clothes.
Yeah.
Which is not true, but they think that they can, and you know, can make a couple of approval decisions. And so you see a lot more movement that way. They haven't gotten it right yet, with the exception of this weird exception of them actually buying a company. And we'll see where that goes. I mean, no one really knows what's going to happen with that label. Label's still doing well. Premium denim is a difficult category to be in, and it's very trendy, and you're only as good as your last season. And you know, we'll see what happens. Did I answer your question? I kind of went off on a tangent.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a fluid kind of a business that it doesn't seem like there's a real template for.
No.
You have the artist, you have the clothing line, you have the economy, you have. I mean, there's so many
variables.
It's not the regular business model. We're not. And I don't think it'll ever be the regular business model. You know, for musicians to say, to sit down with their agent and say, hey, album, touring, and of course, clothing company, soft drink, footwork. I mean, that doesn't. It might happen at some point. Right now, it's not part of the package.
And what I'm hearing from you within the ambit of the recorded music business, that it seems that it's more of a marketing opportunity rather than, hey, let's get rich quick kind of an opportunity.
It is unless you're an A-level player. And if you're an A-level player, like I said, what's interesting is everyone wants to be a designer. There was a moment in 04, 05 where every single hip-hop artist had a clothing brand. Every single one. I went to the Magic Trade Show in Vegas in the urban, what they call it, the urban streetwear division. And it was crazy because not only did they all have this brand, they were all there. And it coincided with like NBA All-Star Game, which was also in Vegas, and it was phenomenal. It was like the BET Awards meets the NBA All-Star Game at all in one room. Everyone, Snoop had launched his line, Shadywear just launched, LL Cool J brought back some did like a Kmart brand, which by the way tanked. Every single one. Nelly had Apple Bottoms. Jay Z was there. I mean, there was some serious power in that room. Most of those brands are gone. I mean, the other interesting thing is these brands, there's no longevity. These are crash and burn, you know, 3 to 5 year business life cycles. The amount of brands that become legacy brands and make it a decade or longer, it's like opening a restaurant. Mm-hmm. The odds are stacked against you. So I think that was probably an important point to make that I didn't make early on. Which is, think of like, you know, in the old days, everyone wanted to open a restaurant, and what percentage of restaurants fail? I mean, it's some obscene number, like 60 or 70% of all restaurants
more
fail.
Than that.
Right. Happens with clothing brands too. So that is a problem. Is everyone can get all excited about it, agree to go in on it, it happens, and if the retail doesn't buy it, you could have, all this stuff's great, but you made it one season and it's gone.
Right. Gary Fine.
Earlier you were talking about what in essence was a percentage of in-pocket money from the royalty that you were willing to pay as the business side of the transaction had to reflect what you were actually receiving and not other things that you weren't receiving. In the music business, obviously, there are all kinds of definitions of net that don't really play fair with that concept. In your business, if what you're asking is that the artist take a lower royalty because you're getting less, that's an easy sell. But are there games with your definitions on the branding side, maybe not yours personally, but I just mean in the business, or do they pretty much say, we're selling end-of-season goods, we're getting less, you're getting less, we're all in this boat together, or is there some things the artist should be aware of where they're getting a reduced royalty at a time that doesn't really justify it?
It's an excellent question. So here's some things to look out for. On the closeout goods definitions, see how broad that definition is, because is it truly end-of-season closeout goods, or am I building goods for some of these people for which I'm now trying to avail myself of that lower royalty rate than I wouldn't otherwise be able to? Am I deducting, if I have multiple brands going to a particular retailer, and that retailer is assessing chargebacks or allowances that are company-wide, for which this capsule collection is maybe a small percentage of the total goods that I'm selling to them, and I have the right to kind of qualitatively account for or apportion as the brand owner. You could be getting screwed on that apportionment because it could be chargebacks related to goods that aren't this specific capsule collection. It's hard to fudge on a sales royalty because the numbers are pretty clear. Profit stuff, and I'll tell you what gets really interesting, is a lot of times the deal will be, hey, you're my partner. I'm going to go and you want to, you know, I'll take advantage of the artist saying, or a client will take advantage of the artist saying, let's be partners on this stuff. And we'll do a few things that are favorable to the artist that makes them sound like a partner even though they haven't invested in anything. And I'll say, well, that's fine. We're going to split the profits. And the moment it becomes a profit analysis and not a sales analysis, you know how that game gets played. I see that a lot. I've done split profit deals. And I'll tell you where it gets interesting is when the artist wants to be a participant and designer and really have a say in it, it's perhaps not unfair to say, well, then let's split the capital risk, meaning if we don't make any profit, you don't get anything either. And definitionally, what will always happen is in the profit analysis, this tiny small brand that's using the facility of the much larger manufacturer will have overhead allocations that just are unreasonable. And that's where the devil's in those details on those overhead allocations. It's a tough one on a net sales definition. Even the untrained eye, you'll catch most of it because it's pretty clear. It's returns, discounts actually taken. We talked about whether these allowances are shipping related chargebacks or end of season markdown co-op stuff, and just making sure that it always is related to and has parameters that are based upon these actual branded goods, this collection, versus any type of discounts or allowances that are our overall business with that particular retailer. I think that would be what to look out for.
Following up on his point, the profit area, you know, how you, on the net proceeds for film, it's very defined in whatever you negotiate for the definition. But the transparency is not necessarily there on the film side, where that's argued. Is it the transparency and the accounting a lot easier in the garment side?
Right. Well, here's what's funny. The good news is most of these companies have banks and factors. Factors, an asset-based lender that advances money off of invoices. Those people are secured creditors with, they have required audited financial statements as opposed to reviewed financial statements, both quarterly and annually. You generally have reputable CPAs on the books. You still can fudge stuff. I mean, I will tell you a very interesting story, which is that, especially as goods are now sourced in China, you can move two, you know, I can sell one out the front door and two out the back door. I can do that all day long. And almost all brands have the ability to do that. I don't think they want to get into trouble, so I don't see when they owe a third party a royalty, you know, they want to take advantage that way. I mean, you're risking a fraud lawsuit. You're risking some pretty bad stuff. It's possible. There are some safeguards, and I don't do a lot of work in pure entertainment. I know that the studio profits definition historically has been, you know, fraught with all sorts of opportunity to take advantage of anyone who was ever a profit participant. I get that. I would like to say it's probably better and easier to figure out. There are a lot of things that go into garment production, but most of it happens under one roof. Most of it happens with one entity and not through affiliates. Most of the goods land from wherever they're made in one facility in California, New York, and get shipped out. So, whereas studios or other people can have all sorts of sales to affiliates, which usually totally muddies the water. One area where it could happen here is if a wholesaler has a retail division and has the retail entity set up as separate standalone companies and it sells a lot to its retailers, or its internet e-commerce business is done through an affiliate and it sells at a below market rate in order to minimize its net sales definition. I suppose those would be opportunities. But you know, fraud generally is, if the guys are dirty,
they're dirty
and it happens in Asia. You know, it's like the goods don't make it here. They just don't come here. If they come here, someone will, there's a packing list and there's shipping documents and the factor has a vested interest. These banks, it's two biggest factors, CIT and Wells Fargo, they're not going to let people, because they have a lien on all those goods, you know, jerk around with those numbers.
Young Susie, would you mind coming to the microphone, or is everyone going to be shy tonight?
You make it, it's such a trek.
Well, I guess, you know,
it's intimidating.
Everyone's just comfortable.
Oh, that's okay.
I'm feeling.
Stand a bit away from the mic here because the levels are going to be really different.
It's over here. Am I supposed to be over here?
We'll let everyone else ask their questions sitting down, but thank you, Susie. All right, Susie Sachs.
Okay, so if I have a brand that is also part, it's based off of a band, and they have a unique style that the people want to emulate, and it has a definite target audience. It's highly recognizable. It's very, very unique. Is it possible to get a deal where, I don't know if it's a clothing company, I don't know the right words, but a line that will participate in the launch. If I have a lot of other things going on where it's like TV, it's music, it's perfumes are coming out, is it possible to also bring into that picture a garment deal?
Yes. Okay. You're going to be on TV. You guys are going to be famous. You're going to get all sorts of exposure. You're wearing very unique clothes. Why shouldn't it be my clothes? And I would love to clothe you guys for free.
Okay.
Maybe even pay you a little bit for the opportunity to get that exposure. You're bringing me exposure because you've got lots of stuff going on, particularly television, which is very expensive for these companies to advertise on. So that would be great.
If it starts out, you know, we're in negotiations and all kinds of different things. Who knows what is really coming and getting signed on the line? What if I start out with something that's like an internet show, and then it's a music launch at the same time, and then we're working on a film. But the film's not done. We launch. Okay, we launch simple. It's internet, and it's music.
It's hard for me to sell you
to
retailers because the consumer doesn't know who you are yet.
That's my question,
I only care about what the consumer... Do you add to my ability to sell to consumers? And if you don't, then what I'll do is I'll say, you have a really compelling story. We seem to match in our style, and... we will put you on our you'll be on the team. You will be one of our sponsors, you know, and we like to have an art division where we take different fine artists, bands, people we think reflect our lifestyle, our culture, you know, fellow tribesmen and tribeswomen, so to speak, of our lifestyle ethic. And we'll probably just give you a bunch of free clothes and invite you to all of our cool stuff. And
which is a great way to start.
Yeah, and keep you, you know, in the family, so to speak. I mean, you hear that all the time.
Okay.
We'll get you kind of a street team relationship. I just don't know whether it's something that I can pay you for at this point.
Yeah, because you had said this. You don't have to be currently selling albums to have a style people want to emulate.
Yes.
Which is very true of my product, my brand, my group, my all of that. But they aren't famous.
I mean, I laugh.
Not yet.
Jerry Garcia still sells ties, right? Is it Jerry Garcia? Who's
the Grateful Dead guy?
Is it the Jerry Garcia tie? There yet?
I don't know.
Right? Arguably, the Dead were never popular music, or if they were popular within even mainstream culture, it was for a very finite amount of time. Jerry's passed away, has he not?
Yeah, he's.
Yeah. But it's still tie. You know, it's still out there in. So you never know. You know, fashion's so funny because they want people that they think are style icons. That's why I think you know, Bruno Mars, there's something that one surprised me in a second. Seemingly now it's the Pepsi commercial. When you get the Sprite commercial, your Sprite commercial, you made it. You know, Drake had his big Sprite commercial. I saw CeeLo or someone had one recently.
My goodness. All right. Was there another question over here? Tara? No? William? No? Daryl?
Yeah.
You're disappointing me.
I'm disappointing.
Yeah, very.
I'm listening.
Okay. Any more questions from you?
I mean, pretty much everything's been answered, but on a, like,
young artist manager.
Right on.
Did you hear about the Swiss Beats deal with Reebok?
No.
Oh, well, Swiss Beats is now, you know, quote unquote, on the board. He's now designing the shoe. He's now doing the commercials. He's now actually soliciting other artists and producers and athletes to join in branding, the rebranding of Reebok. And, you know, I've been hearing just through the grapevine that he, you know, it was a crazy deal that was done. So, I mean, what, just from an outside point of view and your experience, what type of deal do you think
he got?
He got. Because the sales are through the roof now. Reebok is a bag.
I have no idea on the numbers. Clearly in the millions. Who's his wife? Alicia Keys is his wife.
Yeah.
He's a style icon.
Right.
Within hip-hop right now, people like what he's got going, and I think he's on the upward trend. And he knows a lot of people. So he brings a lot of recognition within hip-hop and respect within hip-hop. The idea of, like, being... What do I use as the right term? Like an incubator within for a brand of other artists. That's actually like a Jay-Z thing. When he sold Rock Aware, he bought Artful Dodger, and he said to, I forgot what company bought Rock Aware. It was Iconics. And he said, I still want to go out and, like, come the halls for cool new stuff, and if I think it's cool, then I'll buy the brand or I'll license it or whatever. And I don't think he's bought anything after Artful Dodger,
right.
But it sounds like maybe that's what Reebok's trying to do with Swizz, and they needed a rebrand. I mean, just independently, there was a lot of talk within the industry that they hadn't done anything in a long time. Their strategy was behind in terms of athlete recognition and celebrity recognition, and there are all these different factors, and
right.
I actually saw a guy give a presentation and use that as an example of a brand that it needs to reinvent itself. But what's interesting that we don't know is, was he their second choice? Was he their third choice? I mean, that's the funny thing is, you know, is it because they couldn't go after Drake or someone? Like, you don't know.
That's true.
You know?
But it's like, it was the perfect choice because...
I think so.
I mean, the reason is because he's a producer who has access, who makes hits for all the A-list.
Exactly.
You know, and then
so why doesn't JD have one?
Because, yeah, no disrespect, he's not...
But he knows it, but he has another style, but he knows everybody. I mean, you're right. It's a tough one.
Yeah. But Swizz has the hits. Like,
yes.
Drake, like Jay. Like,
yeah.
You know, Beyonce. Like... It made sense to do it with Swizz because of his access to Lil Wayne and all those guys. And he's, you know, he's been doing it since he was 16. Hits. So, I mean, I think it probably was their first choice because, or if they had somebody smart or they just were incredibly lucky because he is one of the people that's just like at the center of the hip-hop pop culture. And then, like, he's an artist as well. You know, he dabbles in fine art. And it's just he spans vastly and throughout the global entertainment industry.
Yeah, he is.
So it makes sense, but I just heard a lot of different numbers. You know?
I didn't work on it, so I don't know.
Yeah,
but
have you ever even heard of somebody like, okay, well, we're going to put you on a board of this?
No, that I haven't heard. Definitely
so
not that.
Like,
my suspicion is it's on some advisory board as opposed
right.
to the actual board of directors of the
right.
public company. But yeah, I mean, they played it up. They made that deal happen because what's interesting is those are things that I'm sure the artist is saying, I don't want to do this unless I can really have some control.
Exactly.
It's the opposite of the, you know, put my name on a T-shirt and I don't care. And those deals in the old days, that was the norm. Just pay me money. Just,
right. yeah.
you know, I don't care. And now it's I have to be a part of it to the point of actually, you know, maybe being the creative director of a brand incubator of multiple artists. And
but the thing is, Swizz might not be a hot producer in 2 years.
Right.
This, our business changes on a month-to-month basis.
Then he could.
So
you don't know what's going to happen.
Stock, let's just, for all intents and purposes here.
Right.
Maybe he is doing a personality situation as a brand ambassador as opposed to, because you don't know, if he doesn't release a hit like Timberland, it's kind of fallen off the map. If he doesn't release a hit the next year and Lil Wayne records aren't doing real well, these different types of things, you never know what's going to happen, you know? So it's really interesting to see how music, the lifetime is so short. And when you have a musician on a clothing line, you don't know if he's going to be hot in 3 months from now.
It's an excellent point. So you're probably going to do a very short, leash on it. Right.
Yeah.
So you'll probably pay a little more upfront money than you ordinarily would because that's what the artist needs and wants. Frankly, that's your tolerance for risk.
Yeah.
Is I can't guarantee money for it. You certainly can't guarantee money for a long period of time.
Right. Yeah.
I don't care what it is. Fashion just changes.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to, you're lucky to make it 5 years without having to reinvent yourself.
Yeah.
So certainly length of term. The flip side, of course, is if it's really kicking ass in sales, you don't want to let the guy go.
Yeah.
You want it forever if you can, you have that right.
Yeah.
Let's go back to Gary.
Since we're talking about making deals, what do you see from agents or managers or lawyers that can kill the deal in the sense of one of two things? I think a lot of them are on percentages, and I wonder if they have sometimes a resistance to putting much effort into deals that don't have any upfront money, and whether that plays a role in how they negotiate the deal or their interest in getting it done. And apart from that somewhat self-interest that may exist in the deal, are there other things that you see that can kill a deal by band representatives?
It's an excellent question. You hit the number one issue on the head.
You said that for every one of his questions, by the way.
They're all good. They are good questions.
Yeah, pretty good, Gary.
they're good questions. It is upfront money because the professionals that work on a percentage, they are only what's their business interest, which is how do you quantify what's in it for them? What are you going to pay me? What's guaranteed? It is just a absolute tension between guaranteed money and guaranteed money today. I want upfront guaranteed money. They don't want anything contingent. They don't want anything back end. They don't understand profit dollars. And the last thing they want to do is deal with some sort of stock relationship. They don't that's useless to them because co-owning something, developing it, God forbid the artist goes into their own pocket to develop this. What's interesting to me is that the agents and the managers always still want to make a percentage on that. You know, I've had clients that say they're going to buy a restaurant. They're going to buy it. And the agent says, I introduced them to that guy. I get my piece. Are you kidding me? The artist is putting in $1 million is putting in $1 million, not getting money, putting in. If they're successful, it's no different if the artist invests his money in a 401k. You don't get a piece of that. If you introduce them to the financial manager, the wealth manager. So that's one struggle. Another area is on approvals. There's a very fast turn in this business, and for all the right reasons, the artists want to have all sorts of rights of approval. And you see very tight, silence-deemed disapproval, huge lead period. I don't know, my artist might be touring, you might not be not be able to find them for 2-3 weeks, a month, whatever. My response as the brand owner is, I got to move those goods. You have no idea. My calendar is my life. And if you're not around, tough shit. I got to move the goods. And so we fight a lot over approval rights. It's a little fudgy because approval rights on the goods is one thing. Approval rights on the name, image, and likeness in advertising, which I think the artist has a right to control how their image looks. That's fine. If it's branded goods that are signature items, whether the shirt's blue, green, has an 8-inch sleeve, a 6-inch sleeve, at the end of the day, I'm not really hurting the artist's name or reputation in the community. If I can't find them or get that approval, I have to move those goods. And so I really am going to play tough with them on approvals. Extra sort of concert rider kind of stuff, like, fly me around first class and I need hair and makeup. That usually doesn't fly for these guys that don't know how to deal with those requirements. They just don't know how to do it. They don't know who to call. So there can be a tension sometimes in the company saying, I can't give you that. You just provide it. We'll pay you a little extra, I guess, but I can't give you those things. I guess those are kind of the three biggies.
Okay. Was there Charlie? Okay.
What is the best segment within the garment industry to enter into? You mentioned T-shirts because of the gross margins. It's easy to work a deal. Sneakers, hats, you know, what seems to be the thing that if I was a manager or brokering a deal that I would try to go through that Easter egg hunt to find the winning Easter egg?
Well, it's funny. The question was, what's the best type of garment to start in if you're a manager looking to do a deal? It's hard to answer it that way because there has to be a fit stylistically. So we use the Bruno Mars example of the hat. The brand is looking at someone who's going to be able to sell those products to consumers. The artist, if you're the manager or the agent for the artist, you're going to say, what do I think attaching this guy's name to is going to actually move goods? If they're known to have a really cool shoe collection, that's easy. Wear a lot of hats, that's easy.
So it's subjective ad hoc?
It's kind of subjective ad hoc, and you just need to see, you know, who you think you can create a synergy with that the consumer would ultimately resonate with, that then when you go pitch that to the brand owner, they're going to say, oh, yeah, I get it. We could totally move product together. I was using T-shirts and hats are kind of synonymous. I call that imprintable stuff. T-shirt, hat, fleece it's cheap to make. It's easy. I can get your creative input. You can design a few things. I can put your face on it. It's very easy. Cut and sew goods are difficult. Cut and sew garments they're designed. Unless you're a designer, it's difficult for the artist to be able to creatively input what happens there. It hasn't stopped all these, all these musicians because they all think that they're designers. Mm-hmm. But that's a tough one to answer. I'm sorry.
Mr. Wiseman, you brought up Bruno Mars on a couple of occasions. With regards to the morals clauses, are morals clauses, because he was arrested for cocaine in Vegas, are you seeing that kind of an ad hoc kind of situation? How big is the dent that we're going to take on this guy, and how bad, was he a pedophile or was he just doing cocaine? It just seems that morally that people just kind of like turn their head on some things. Does moral clause mean that much in this business?
Can I say it again? That's a great question.
Of course.
So
morals clause in the brand business.
Right.
Yeah.
Generally, there is a morals clause. Actually, you see a lot of contracts where they forget about it because they get wrapped up in doing a deal and they forget they're dealing with an individual who could have a public image problem. Mm-hmm. What's funny is if the goods still sell, no one will pull the plug. Mm-hmm. And so what you see is a more tolerant business relationship between brand owner and celebrity that got into trouble depending upon how the consumer reacts. You'll never see anything proactive. You almost rarely, I suppose if someone was arrested, for killing someone, pedophile, some fairly terrible stuff, someone might preemptively pull the plug. Interestingly, and I don't know the answer to this, I don't know, for example, maybe someone in the audience knows whether, like with Michael Vick, whether they immediately canceled or terminated all of his endorsement deals or not, whether they waited to let that thing play out. A lot of times with an arrest, depending on how the morals clause is written, if the talent got its way, it says conviction. And if the brand gets its way, it says arrest or not, or it's, any act or, how do we usually write these things, any act, I'm going to say that something for which there's a public, it's late, I'm tired. I'm going to write it unrelated to the arrest. I'll have an arrest/conviction clause, but I'm also going to have something that's far more obtuse in terms of language that says any act which is brought to the national attention that brings our brand into public disrepute or something that just, Tiger Woods. Make it very subjective, very broad, very favorable to me. I'm going to watch how it plays out. And if I think that there's been a public outcry, then yes, we're going to dump him. Then we hopefully have interesting post-termination rights in the agreement about what we do and whether we owe him or not. And interestingly, you can even argue, you know, do royalties cut off all of a sudden? If I terminate for that, I still sell out my goods and do it royalty-free. You can get creative and create. You're saying no. Well, sometimes.
I'm saying you can't negotiate that.
Right.
But that would be malpractice to me.
But, hey, listen. When you are trying to convince someone that they don't want to behave badly, and it's very difficult for in this negotiation.
You can terminate the relationship, but you can't make the argument that, oh, and we're going to make money. We're terminating our relationship with you because you've done something wrong.
And we're still going to make money on you.
We're still going to make money.
Well, I could argue that you. But if I've terminated with you, it's because you've done something that's caused me a lot of damage. And I might make that either a liquidated damages provision that says I'm going to be able to do that stuff for free, because that may or may not start to cover the damage to my brand that may or may not exist beyond just the termination right.
But then that's different. A breach of contract claim
right.
is different than making
a termination right.
Okay. So that's
right.
So I think the royalty, which is the issue, that's the scenario
right.
in, is different than a breach of contract claim.
Agreed.
Very good. Well, Michael Vick, a pox on him for his crimes. Let's finish this up with one last question for me. Where do you see the future of artists working with brands going?
It's unlimited.
Unlimited?
I think the progression for me is to see these things get far more complicated, and probably to have started from what was purely an endorsement deal without any creative input, co-branding, co-owning, to the example of Swizz Beatz and the other artists that are developing brands with other companies, developing capsule collections, Miley Cyrus doing a collab with Max Azria for BCBG, which actually didn't do very well. It was very widely reported to have failed. These are creative people, and the fashion business is a creative business, so the possibilities of synergy, I think, are endless.
Very good. Huge round of applause for Brett. Especially for pretty much carrying the program tonight, but I think you'll agree it was, he's pretty, a lot of meat on the bone there. So thank you once again. I have 1,000 more questions, so we may have to do this again soon. And thank you very much for attending this evening. Please make sure that you check our website, subscribe to our email newsletters if you don't already. And if you tweet, send out a nice tweet about our event tonight and how cool.
I'm on Twitter.
Yeah, there we are. So send out a tweet about how great Mr. Weissman was tonight. So thanks very much again. Huge round of applause. And there goes the camera.
Thank you for listening. Join NARIP now and come to an event near you. NARIP. Get connected. Stay connected.